Picture this. An employee wakes up at 6 o'clock in the morning and goes to log in to their company network. Pretty soon it's obvious something is wrong. The usual services aren't working. Files are not where they're supposed to be, or they are simply not activating. Or worse, there's a splash screen with a skull image and the words that every IT person and manager hopes they will never have to see. Your files have been encrypted and locked. A cyber attack is not pretty. This is a time for making decisions and taking action under great pressure and amid enormous fear. In pulling this all together, there is one person that you must never forget to call. This person's number should already be on your emergency contact list right at the top. This person needs to be at your side right now. This person is your breach coach. I'm Steve Prentice, and this is the Talis Security Sessions podcast. That's a stressful opening. But nothing like as stressful as recognizing yourself and your company as the latest victim of a cyber attack. It is therefore my great pleasure and relief to have as my guest Dan Michaluk, National Co-Leader of Privacy and Cybersecurity at the law firm BLG in Toronto, Canada. Dan, welcome to the Talis Security Sessions podcast.
Thanks, Steve. It's nice to be here today.
The whole notion of a breach coach. This is a new thing for a lot of people. I mean, we're all painfully familiar with the idea of cybersecurity, of data breaches, and of ransomware, and many organizations have worked hard to prepare for such an eventuality. But the idea of having somebody on staff or on retainer who is specifically prepared for this process is a fascinating thing. So let's start with a case study, Dan. Can you share an example of a high-stakes breach that you have worked on and what lessons were learned by you and by your clients from this?
Yeah, sure. It's public knowledge and fairly widely known that the team that I co-lead was supported Toronto Public Library in its cyber attack. That was a cyber attack that I believe came to the library's attention in the latter half of 2023 and then took well into 2024 to resolve. I can't comment about that incident at all, and I won't, but I can talk about learnings in general that our team is kind of focused on right now. And I would say that our greatest learnings right now are all focused on trying to help organizations notify individuals affected by mass data theft more quickly. So you lose hundreds of gigabytes of data. And in the past, we would default to what's been called the standard, which is to do like individual file analysis and notify individuals about how they specifically are affected. And there's certainly a trend and a greater tolerance for analyzing data sets as a whole and notifying populations, which is much faster. So we're making an adjustment, we're following the trend, and we're helping our clients be a little more efficient in getting through these incidents.
What's the best practice for alerting populations? Does it come down to a mass emailing to everyone on a list, or is there something more efficient than that?
You can do a mailing, but mass notifications are commonly done online. So you put up a notice on your website that says, if for example, you received this service between this date and this date, you are likely to be affected, and the data elements associated with the exposed information are as follows. Much quicker and much easier, although there's a degree of uncertainty in defining the population always. That's the trick in this, is gaining enough comfort with the population-based notice to actually go ahead and do it.
When libraries or small towns are attacked, it always seems to be a bit of a surprise, at least to an outside observer, given that they are not the big brand names, and they seem to be much more of a soft target. Some experts have suggested that they are ransomware targets specifically because they are so well insured, generally, and that they pay up quickly. Is that what you have seen?
Well, you use the term softer target, which I think we should come back to, but our team works particularly in the public and the health sectors, provincial public, municipal public. We focus on that, and those sectors do seem to be targeted right now, and I don't know why. I can theorize, you know, it could be because they're perceived as information-rich targets. It could be because they're perceived as soft targets, as you say. You know, I'm not really sure if they are perceived to pay or not. I can't really, in our own experience, draw a distinction between public sector entities and private sector entities, frankly. In fact, they might even pay less. But I'm really not sure about that, Steve.
Well, whether a soft target or a more prominent one, the idea of a breach coach seems to be a must-have, and now, Dan, you yourself are one. Who in the professional world is most qualified to fill this role?
Yeah, so I am a breach coach, and I work with a team of lawyers who are breach coaches, too. The role is generally assigned to external legal counsel now, and it's a position that's really been fostered by the cyber insurers who vet external lawyers for their qualities and capabilities and put them on breach coach panels. So if you have cyber insurance, you want to check with your insurer as to what lawyers are on your breach coach panel and take a look at who you'd prefer to work with on those panels.
And in this role, what exactly do you do?
I think I like the term coach, but I don't like the word breach, let me say. I try to avoid it, but we're lawyers first and legal advisors first and foremost, but it's a very practical form of legal advice. We're not writing a lot of long form opinions in the midst of a crisis, right? Our advice is really geared to process and helping clients anticipate and helping them follow best practice so they can best mitigate their legal risks and the other associated risks, so reputational risks, and so on and so forth. The key value is in doing incident after incident after incident and allowing clients to anticipate and make decisions in light of better foresight, I would say.
So as an anticipatory activity, are you on call or on retainer long before an event were to happen? I mean, most people don't like to think about disastrous events happening to them, so I can imagine there's a good deal of procrastination in taking on a breach coach along with the expense of your services. So do you get called in kind of like the Navy SEALs team after a cyber attack has already occurred?
Organizations are getting better. They should all be finding lawyers who they like in advance. And we're certainly doing that and building relationships with clients. If we do that, we give them coordinates and a protocol to contact us and we're called in and snap to action right away. There's still maybe 40% of our engagements come from strange organizations who are being introduced to us by insurers for the very first time. The insurer will get a call from a client who hasn't done advanced work on connecting with the lawyer, and the insurers will say right off the bat, you need to contact BLG, who can act as your breach coach. And we're right into it. You know, new relationship in tough circumstances, but we do our best.
When we look at that name again, breach coach, not every cyber attack is a data breach, obviously. Some of them could be ransomware or other kinds of sabotage or an advanced persistent threat actor wheedling their way in and simply lurking around and finding weaknesses inside a situation. Do you diversify your expertise or do you focus solely on data breaches?
We are counsel on the cyber incident response process. So it would be a mistake for an organization to manage a cyber incident as not raising any legal concerns because data exposure isn't apparent from day one. There are all sorts of risks other than data exposure. For example, service disruption can cause all sorts of legal and other business risks that need to be thought of from day one. And deferring the matter of data exposure and treating it as a non-issue until you get to day 10, for example, usually means you haven't done the right things in advance of day 10 to set you up for day 10. So, if it's a major, which is not always easy to define, but if it's a major incident, it's always best to bring in a breach coach at time zero or closely thereafter.
As I was saying just a moment ago, there's a good deal of denial and procrastination in the general marketplace with regards to the type of preparation required. So before your team would ever be called upon, simply in terms of training employees and management in cybersecurity best practices, cyber hygiene, and so on, are you noticing overall that organizations of any size, and I imagine you must work with larger companies, but please correct me if I'm wrong here, especially from an executive C-suite level, that organizations are becoming more aware and more proactive about this? Or do many still consider cybersecurity response a matter of crossing that bridge when they come to it?
I see organizations are becoming better. IT departments were the first to get on preparation game. They've been preparing and looking at NIST and other response frameworks for years now, maybe 5 years, let's say, for your typical IT department. And then in the past couple of years, more and more, I think boards are showing interest in response. And when the boards are interested and when the IT teams are interested, all of a sudden you have executive leadership in the middle becoming interested as well. And I think you really need all three groups to be engaged, and we're seeing more and more of that now.
In terms of the situations that you have seen thus far, is there anything that has surprised you? What is the most surprising or maybe unexpected challenge you have faced when dealing with a breach?
So we're always trying to anticipate the surprises. It's part of that service, right? Anticipation and talking in terms of risks and probabilities. So this bad thing is likely not going to happen, but you should be aware that it's this percentage likely to happen. So we try to anticipate and avoid surprises. I think the most surprising thing is I can think of is we had a threat actor just disappear, which they do from time to time. Maybe law enforcement is closing in or something. So they go from an identified entity to nothing overnight, and always a risk. We had an approval on a ransom payment that was made, and prior to payment, luckily, the threat actor just vaporized and went away. So those are, you know, that's about as big and surprising as we want to deal with. And again, it's our job to kind of let the clients know that that's a possibility, so they're able to kind of weigh that risk.
And that leads perfectly to the issue of establishing a policy around whether to pay ransoms or not pay ransoms. Governmental agencies all around the world are often very good at saying don't pay ransoms, and some companies don't, but others simply see it as the cost of doing business. Obviously, that's a topic you guide your clients on, but is the idea of not paying a ransom, this proactive idea from a government agency to say don't pay ransoms on any account, or is this more of a pie in the sky concept?
Yeah, that policy is discussed more and more. I think it has to be approached carefully because it's becoming rarer and rarer, but there will be situations where there's a, let's call it a significant data loss issue that really warrants payment, right? I'm not talking about data suppression, where you're paying a threat actor to delete information that's been stolen. I think that's a more tenuous proposition always and difficult. I'm talking about where there has been a significant backup problem that's led to a scenario in which critical business records will simply not be there unless you pay for a decryptor and try to decrypt. In that scenario, you can cost the recovery. Those records will need to be manually recovered and rebuilt. And there are various means to do that. And you can kind of put together a number and a timeline. And then it's that cost, that number, and the timeline that can be avoided by payment of a ransom. And I think in some circumstances, it will be a compelling case to pay. Again, more and more rare, but are the policymakers who are interested in that option accounting for that? Because there's a cost to the policy in that scenario.
What are you observing with regards to the threat actors themselves? I mean, cybercrime is a very profitable industry. Have you seen, let's say, an evolution in skills or approaches or even the corporate structure of threat actors? I mean, there are different types of threat actors, of course, numerous levels from nation states down to smaller gangs. I have observed myself many of them are getting more sophisticated, if only to compete with each other. So are you seeing anything with regards to how things have changed over the last, let's say, 5 years in the performance of cybercrime gangs?
Yeah, I'll say, Steve, I'm not the best threat intelligence expert. Like, you know, we deal with threat actors all the time, but we hire threat intelligence experts to give us threat intelligence. So I'm one step removed from that. Most of the criminals that we deal with are organized ransomware gangs. They have capabilities that I perceive as good. They're certainly good enough to get into the networks of our clients, you know, and it's hard to secure a network from characters like this. If they're a branded actor, and most of the threat actors that we deal with have a brand and a business name that they trade upon, they're fairly reliable in their dealings, right? They're trading on their name. So you can count with a fairly high degree of probability that if you pay them for something, they're going to deliver the something, like 95% likely. And you can count with a fairly high degree of probability that if you don't pay them and they're threatening to do something like leak data on the dark web, they will. So that's who we're dealing with. They're all using, most are using double extortion nowadays. And we saw that come up maybe 2 or 3 years ago now and is the consistent norm. Other than that, it's pretty standard and stable, I would say, from my perspective at least.
Double extortion being a tactic in which cybercriminals not only encrypt a victim's data, but also threaten to leak or sell it, which remains a risk even if the victim restores their data from backups. There are some of the more sophisticated threat actor players who provide help desks even and tutorials to assist their victims in not getting caught again, which is nice in that kind of genteel James Bond villain type of niceness. But yeah. Going back to the description of a cyber attack that I used in the opening of this episode, the employee has woken up 6 o'clock in the morning to a very different workday. When do you come into the picture?
The reports that we get come in after the fact, so we usually get called mid-morning. And it comes mid-morning because usually somebody from IT wakes up at 6 o'clock in the morning and either tries to log in or goes in and realizes that some services aren't working. And there's a little bit of exploration done, and they find maybe a ransom note that's tucked away in the root directory of an endpoint. And that's pretty good validation. Sometimes they'll work with a managed security service provider to do a little bit of triage investigation and validate that it's the real deal. And then before they have called us, they've hopefully done a forceful containment, which means network containment. Firewalls go up and all services come down. All of that happens before they contact us at like 9:30, 10:30 in the morning. And then we get the call and we will immediately line up we call it an incident response technical vendor, a vendor who can both deal with forensics and deal with guidance on restoration. Those things come together because if you're restoring without a view to the investigation, you will pave over your evidence, basically. So that's how it starts.
Your team at BLG is now well known for their role in breaches or cyber attacks of this nature. So the company calls you in. If it was feasible, do you think it would have been a good idea for that victim organization to have established a breach coach person or department internally, someone in their own legal department to take care of this? Or is it better that they rely on external experts?
Yeah, unless you can find a retired breach coach who's been on the front lines doing hundreds a year, you're probably best to go external. I mean, the value in our services is based on that experience that is always up to date and that's ongoing. And if you go internally, again, you could have a great mind, maybe even someone that's a former breach coach who knows a lot, but won't have the up-to-date knowledge of process.
Well, that's a classic as-a-service model right there, staying on top of what's going on right now. Having access to a breach coach from a law firm is then a top priority for any organization. But just to complete that line of thought, if a company doesn't call you in and doesn't bring in a breach coach at all, what kinds of dangers are they facing above and beyond the obvious of losing their data? What are the dangers to a company if they do not proceed with your particular expertise?
Well, I mean, you can do all this yourself, but what we really try to do is keep organizations on best practice in a context in which these attacks are highly visible, right? You know, in the olden days, and this was the reality maybe 5 years ago, organizations would hire a recovery company, right? And they would use the recovery company for its expertise in recovering the network, and they would kind of ignore all the other stuff. The challenge is that these incidents, even that incident, assuming network containment, would be very visible to employees, customers, the public and stuff. And it's that visibility that creates a whole bunch of pressure to do it the right way. So again, if that IT company doesn't appreciate that there's some due diligence that needs to be put into the data theft issue, they may pave over data. And then you're in a hole eventually managing all those stakeholders. It still happens. We had one recently too, where a company went through a restoration exercise without engaging us. They had a ransom note, but they didn't think it was real. So they didn't engage with the threat actors, which is important to control your adversary and keep your adversary visible. And they finally realized that the threat was real when some data was actually published on the dark web. We were engaged at that point, and then we're working on getting the data taken down. It's already out there, so we're not as in control as we would have been if we started on day one and walked them through the kind of the best process.
That's a very interesting point about engaging the adversary, something that's not often mentioned. Thinking further about things that are not sufficiently mentioned, what are some of the things that organizations could do today to be better prepared for a breach and maybe not even need your services?
There's a whole range of things that you could spend to avoid a breach. One of the more expensive things that I think is important if you're in a sector that's being targeted is having a best-in-class endpoint detection tool on your network and have that monitored with a 24/7 SOC. It's just pricey and out of range for many of the entities that we deal with. In hindsight, becomes something that weighs heavily on them. We should have spent the money on this, you know, and they try to after, and some have the money and some don't, but it's a very important piece of protection.
So as a final question, the big new elephant in the room is, of course, AI. I recognize that, as you said, you operate one level removed from direct cybersecurity, as opposed to focusing on threat intelligence specifically, but do you have any words to say about AI? Clearly, threat actors are already using AI for any opportunity to improve their criminal skills. Do you give advice to organizations with regards to their use of AI and generative AI within their organizations? What should they be careful about at this moment?
Yeah, we're dealing a lot with AI, not on security mandates, really, but from a general governance perspective, right? Like, are you adopting AI with a thoughtful appreciation of the risks? Who's approving the tools? What tools are they? What processes have you gone through in vetting them? That's not about the cybersecurity threat and about the threat actor's use of AI. I wonder about that. I think most of the organizations we deal with are not being picked off by sophisticated AI spoofing or phishing schemes, right? They're getting picked off by the basic stuff. Unpatched vulnerabilities because they haven't been able to keep up. Regular phishing, which may be AI enabled, right? Like the phishing messages are getting better than we've seen before, obviously. And other really low hanging fruit, right? It's the basics that really need to be tended to. And maybe if you're a bank or a military entity, you've got to be concerned about really sophisticated AI-based attacks. But it's not something that comes up day to day for our practice.
So the low-hanging fruit still works. Well, Dan, you have delivered a compelling set of circumstances as well as reasons for having a breach coach on speed dial. I truly appreciate you giving us your time in this way today. Do you have any final thoughts, anything else that I might have missed?
No, other than I think this is the theme of the presentation is that breach coaches are really valuable advisors who can help organizations prepare. If you don't have one in mind, you should reach out and figure out who's on your insurer's panel and breach coaches. And talk to a couple and have them brief you on various things and learn about the gaps between your incident response plan and the reality of attacks. And there's a lot of value in that for very minimal investment. And it's something that I'd encourage everybody to do.
Dan Michaluk, National Co-Leader of Privacy and Cybersecurity at the law firm BLG in Toronto. Thank you very much for joining me here today on the Talos Security Sessions podcast.
Really nice to be here, Steve. Thanks for the invite.
Remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and tell a friend or a colleague or a client or your breach coach or all of them about the Talos Security Sessions podcast. We will be back again soon with another episode and another discussion on the topics that you need to know about to successfully carry on in the business of information security. Until then, I'm Steve Prentice. Thanks for listening.